and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with this historical moment in American political history, where one party, the Republican Party, is beginning to crack up following the capture of the GOP by Donald Trump, while the other party, the Democrats, are poised to stumble into an historic opportunity with weak candidates and a divided party. Keith Poole, the distinguished chair in the Department of Political Science in the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, just out in a second edition, joins us. We'll discuss the breakup of the Republican Party, the coming reckoning within the Democratic Party, and the likely change in the judiciary with the Supreme Court reversing its long march to the far right. Then we'll assess the growing wildfires in Canada that are now spreading from the province of Alberta into Saskatchewan and speak with Stephen Pine, an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and the author of History of Fire Since 1960, and joins us to discuss how there is little that can be done to stop these large fires in boreal forests, and as history shows, they can last for months until the winter snows put them out. Then finally, we will examine the tyranny of the weak in North Korea, where the country and its people are suffering under crippling sanctions because of its nuclear program, but now its young dynastic leader, Kim Jong-un, is claiming he will not use nuclear weapons first, and North Korea, quote, will faithfully fulfill its obligation for nonproliferation and strive for global denuclearization. Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University, joins us to discuss whether North Korea's pursuit of a nukes and butter strategy will work now that they have some 20 nuclear weapons and will have about 100 by 2020. And joining us now is Keith Poole, who's the Philip H. Alston Jr. Distinguished Chair in the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Ideology in Congress and Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of American Democracy. And his latest book, just out in its second edition, is Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keith Poole.
Glad to be here.
And Keith, as a political science and a longtime student of American history and politics, how do you see this Trump phenomenon? It's pretty extraordinary.
Well, yes, it is. It's very extraordinary. I think it's both the Trump phenomena and the Sanders phenomena are fueled by different demographic groups, but they're fueled by the fact that inequality in the United States has just exploded since the 1970s, and that wealth and income are concentrated in the top one-tenth of 1% to such a degree we haven't seen since we've had good records since 1913. And as a since the end of the Great Recession, about 60% of all the gain recovery has gone to the top 1%. So that the Rust Belt, and people have sort of ignored the fact we keep calling it Rust, the Rust Belt and the coal country and big chunks of the southern United States are just wastelands. And that's one of the reasons why you've seen this tremendous uptick in heroin usage. And people are just angry. They feel like nobody pays any attention, and that the political parties are just, you know, creatures of the rich. And as a consequence, we're headed into a period, I think, where the Republican Party is for certain going to break up over this election. I wouldn't be surprised to see. I know that the Weekly Standard National Review Group, the conservative intellectuals, are looking hard for somebody to run as a conservative third-party candidate. Democrats shouldn't cheer too much about this, because even though the Democrats will almost certainly win the presidency, and therefore swing the Supreme Court to the left. The fact is that they haven't done anything about the concentration of income and wealth in the top 1%. And if you're going to get the money to expand social programs, you're going to tax somebody. And I kind of doubt that Hillary Clinton is going to turn on her friends in the financial industry who've done so much for her and her husband over the years. So we need fundamental reform, and I think the only way we can get there is first, Republican Party has to break up. That will put tremendous pressure on our Democratic Party, because just to give you one cynical example, as a veteran, Vietnam veteran myself, I'm 100% disabled due to exposure to Agent Orange in Vietnam. Now, I succeeded in getting through the process. But the Democratic Party is so beholden to the government union that they tolerate the VA letting veterans die and not doing it, rather than taking on the union and changing the rules so that these people in these hospitals that are destroying records of sick veterans are not fired, let alone indicted and tried in a court. Now, this will, once the Republican Party is gone, not gone, but, you know, decimated, as a shield, these abuses in the public schools are a nightmare in cities like Los Angeles, like Chicago, and so on. All this is going to get exposed, and poor people are going to be asked, well, what have you done for us lately? And the answer is nothing.
Again, I'm speaking with Keith Poole, who is the Philip H. Alston, Jr. Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia, and a Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Ideology in Congress, Political Bubbles, Financial Crises, and the Failure of American Democracy. And his latest book, just out in its second edition, is Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. So, just to sum up then, Keith, we're at a historic moment where the Republican Party is very likely to crack up because of the Donald Trump phenomenon, which is splitting the party, and that's pretty evident from anybody who follows the news. But on the other side, the Democratic Party at this historic moment will sort of stumble into the White House as opposed to sweep into the White House with any enthusiasm. There's very little enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, and as we now approach these last primaries, it seems to me that Bernie Sanders could win Oregon, Washington, and even California, further complicating or not making the Democratic race particularly clear. So what's your sense on whether Bernie Sanders, what do you think he's going to do in terms of these next few primaries? And will she be weakened?
I'd have to look at the list, but I think Bernie Sanders could run the table in terms of, you know, winning the rest of the primaries, except where there's a heavy African-American population, he's likely to win everything. Because, again, if you listen to his speeches, he's tapping into this rage. It's too bad he didn't call me up, because what I would have told him, and maybe somebody will get his ear, is that what he should have done when he was interviewed by, I think it was the New York Times editorial board and a few others, he should just come right out and say that he would repeal Dodd-Frank, which is a horror show, was just handed, you know, let these criminals off the hook. People don't believe what I'm saying out there in radio land. Read Reckless Endangerment and then ask yourself, why wasn't Goldman Sachs criminally indicted as a criminal organization for what it did? What he should be campaigning on in terms of when he talks about the financial industry is repealing Dodd-Frank, reinstating Glass-Steagall, and repealing the deregulation of the financial industry that's taken place since the late 70s. Obviously, leaving things that people really like interstate banking and bank machines and so on. And so if these people want to gamble, you know, if they want to run their casinos, let them go to London. They've run off with the money. They've impoverished millions of people. Why should they keep that money? Why aren't these people in jail? Why weren't those banks broken up? Why didn't Obama do anything? And again, this is well known amongst progressive economists who are highly critical of Obama in private. I know this because I've talked to them. It's just an utter outrage what's been done to ordinary Americans. And the reason why these trade agreement things resonate is the fact that, it's just the ruination of huge areas of the United States. And we've let our infrastructure completely collapse. And if we could rebuild our highways and improve the railway connections to highways, we might get back some of the light manufacturing, like furniture making, which was once big here in the South. But yet, President Obama, I don't know where I read this, but we've made this criticism ourselves, my co-authors and I. They get the stimulus package passed, which the Republicans were critical of, but in fact, there were a lot of good things in it. But instead of then pivoting to infrastructure where he would have gotten a lot of Republican support, he went after the ACA. And, I don't care where you live in the United States, you look around, the roads are a nightmare. They're deteriorating, they're collapsing, and the bridges, et cetera, et cetera. That would have put a lot of people back to work. And the only way we're going to, we know this from all the, we're talking about some of the same issues today as we talked about in 1969, 1970, and 1971. We've got to do something about the concentrated poverty in the cities. Well, the only thing we know that works is to give people money and let them move where they want to move. Let them have the money. And the Democratic Party doesn't want to do that because they believe in centralized control of everything. Republicans are so brain dead now that they've forgotten that, building things actually helps improve the economy. So that it will take the breakup of the Republican Party this cycle, and then I think, as you aptly summarized my thinking, the Democratic Party, like a zombie, is going to stumble along for a couple of cycles, and people are really going to get mad by 2020 when nothing happens.
Well, do you think, though, Keith Poole, that something could happen? What's the difference, in other words, between a Clinton presidency and a Bernie Sanders presidency? Bernie Sanders is 74 years old.
Yeah, I think the difference is that Bernie Sanders is a democratic socialist, and that's okay, but his international views are about as, totally unrealistic, just as Trump's views are totally unrealistic. The fact of life is that after World War II, the United States got stuck stabilizing the Western world. And Harry S. Truman, who was one of my father's heroes, Harry S. Truman stabilized the Western world and essentially saved Western civilization. FDR saved Western civilization by acting the way he did beginning in 1939. But Truman finished the job by stabilizing Europe and stabilizing the Far East with these military alliances. And people may not like it, having been a part of the effort to contain communism myself, but we're stuck with this, and we can't walk away from it. And this is where I think Obama's been profoundly mistaken, and there's a reason why all of these retired defense secretaries have written scathing books about the way Obama thinks about these things. And if you listen very carefully to what Hillary Clinton is saying, she's just basically saying that Obama basically doesn't know what he's doing, and I will fix things. quite seriously, if you listen carefully to what she says, and that's what she's saying. And the American people, it's a tough thing to sell, I realize, but we can't disengage. And you can see the whole Middle East is on fire. China is being led by a leader now who's the most ideological sense now. And the military in China is extremely aggressive. Putin is extraordinarily dangerous. Your listeners might want to read Putin's Kleptocracy. I'll repeat that. Putin's Kleptocracy.
Right, by Karen DeWisher. Yeah, well, I've had her
on. Yeah, it's a brilliant book.
I've interviewed her a couple of times.
Just brilliant. Yeah. And Putin is like a spider trapped in his own web, and he can never quit. But he's basically, all you need to know about Putin is the fact that I think he must be the first leader. I don't know whether Lenin drank heavily or not, but Putin doesn't drink. And that in itself is fascinating. But Putin is extremely dangerous. We need to have mechanized brigades on the borders of the Balkans, not to engage in war. That's the point. You need a strong military as a deterrent, which is something that Bush II forgot. And you need it sitting there to stop Putin from trying to take back the Baltics and giving Poland problems. So you couple this overseas difficulties that we're in with the fact that we need profound reform in education and a number of other institutions in the United States. And the party system is just simply not working. Republican Party, you can kiss it goodbye. They'll never elect a president again. Because once they break in two, there's no way that they can put together a coalition and elect a president because the demographics are changing on them. President Bush, W. Bush, to his credit, understood this and tried to get these people to pass immigration reform. Bush, in 2004, took 40% of the Hispanic vote and speaks Spanish. And he knows, being from Texas, that that's the route to take. But Trump has closed that off, probably alienated Hispanics for a generation. So it's going to be a huge mess because I don't know, Hillary Clinton is going to be, and I'm just assuming that she's going to win. She comes in, she'll have this tremendous pressure from the left because of Sanders' successes. So she's going to have to do something on taxes. But in order to get that through Congress, she's going to have to make deals. And she's already said she can make deals. And again, listen carefully to what she's saying. But it's going to be very difficult to pull it off because she's got to have the revenue because our debt is rising rapidly. The debt really isn't the problem. It's the interest on the debt, right? We have to pay interest on all this debt. And that in itself is going to be a huge burden on the budget within the next 5 to 6 years. So we've got to act. We should have acted. And there's another failure of not only Obama, but the Congress in general, is that they could have acted on the Simpson-Bowles proposals. And and Obama didn't exercise leadership.
Well,
he should have insisted that that Congress vote yes or no on that package.
Well, look, let's just wrap up here in the last couple of minutes, Keith. Some of the very important points you've made. One, that the Republican Party is going to crack up, and it is
cracking.
It's in the process
exactly.
of cracking up. That two, the Democrats under Obama missed the boat. They should have invested in infrastructure, particularly when interest rates were so low, which
yes.
they still are, but still it's basically free money. It was a huge missed historical opportunity. And also that the ACA was probably a distraction. Nobody's particularly happy with it. I'm not sure that it's better than nothing, but let's give him a break on that one.
I do. And I want to just, I know we have to wrap up, but Let me make clear that I think that there's more good than bad in the ACA, but it needs to be adjusted. That's obvious to everybody.
Right.
We need a package of fixes for it to make it work better, yes.
Right. But then on these races, the Democrats are not going to win because they're particularly clever. They're going to stumble into a historic opportunity. But you've got two candidates, one of whom is historically would be the oldest president in history, and the other one who's not in great health and is not a great campaigner. So the only good that's going to come out of this, assuming there's some down-ticket damage and they pick up the Senate, is a change in the Supreme Court. Anything you want to add here in the last minute?
Yeah, I think that's about right. I do believe, though, that Hillary Clinton will make a heroic effort to get rid of the sequester and try to make some deal, coupling tax simplification such that she can get the revenue to deal with some of the problems that we've discussed. I think she recognizes that. She's not trustworthy. I think that everybody knows that. But on the other hand, she doesn't want to go down in history as another failed president. And so she will make a big effort. And I wish her Godspeed on that. But we're really in trouble, and I would say to everybody to, just suck it up. The United States has shown in its long history that we have been able to rise to the occasion in the past, and the Trump phenomena may prove to be our salvation in the sense of breaking up one of the parties and enforcing a reform in the other party, and then we'll see maybe a new party emerge that maybe might be called a kind of a Bill Buckley or a Jack Kemp-type party that sort of believes in minimal government, but coupled with extensive aid to the less fortunate in society.
Well, Keith Poole, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You bet. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Keith Poole, who's the Philip H. Alston Jr. Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Ideology and Congress and Political Bubbles, Financial Crises and the Failure of American Democracy. And his latest book, just out in its second edition, is Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing the growing wildfires in Canada. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Pine, an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and the author of a number of books, the latest of which is History of Fire Since 1960. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pine.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
And the fires in Alberta are spreading into Saskatchewan. They're massive. I've seen the pictures from space, and they're out of control. And we've seen extraordinary footage of convoys of cars going through what looks like a kind of nuclear holocaust. So what's your... I take it that you're not attributing this entirely to climate change, but... Your feeling is that global warming is a contributing factor, but that we have a striking collision of the tar sands industry, one of the dirtiest of fossil fuels, with a boreal forest built to burn put a fossil fuel-powered city between them, and then you have quite a spectacle. So that's your analysis.
In very shorthand. The situation is that this part of the world, boreal Canada, particularly outside the Canadian Shield, is prone to very large fires. This is not a huge fire by the standards of this. Actually, in 1950, there's a well-documented fire, the Chinchaga Fire. It started in May in northeastern British Columbia and burned across Alberta until October, 3 million acres in all. So this area, the vegetation, the climate, the terrain, all can favor very large fires. Now, does that mean there's no global warming contribution? I'd be very surprised if there wasn't, but it's going to be very hard to prove in a particular incident here. What I find really striking is that the Earth has two great combustion realms, one of which burns living landscapes. That's the boreal forest is a great example. The other is burning lithic landscapes, and that's typical of the kind of city, Fort McMurray, that has grown up in support of the tar sands industry, burning fossil fuels. And for the most part, these two stay separate. But we're beginning to see on the fringes of cities more and more collisions. This is the most spectacular one I can think of, horrific. But I'm really struck by the images that are coming out of it, how many of the damages and supports are all cars, gasoline trucks, resupply, all images of these two worlds coming together. And I've always thought of them as competing. You tend to have one or the other at any time. But now we're, in addition to that, we're also, I think, seeing them colluding. They're starting to fold together, even create a kind of positive feedback. And so I think this is a particularly striking but also alarming example of that trend. I say that as a long perspective historian of fire.
Well, you know, apparently Fort McMurray has been recently dubbed Fort McMoney because of so many people flocking to work on the tar sands. And apparently there's been a huge housing crunch and people are getting massive salaries but living in trailer parks. And I imagine it's been pretty haphazard. And that probably explains why the fires are able to claim so many structures. But as far as I can tell, the actual tar sands themselves and the big pits and the lakes and the storage facilities, where I think I saw a clip of a fireman saying that if it ever hits this place, you know, it'll be like a nuclear bomb going off.
Yeah, that's another issue. We don't know, you know, what's going to happen. I'm saying the collision is that the byproducts of tar sands and indeed fossil fuel in general are creating a world in which sort of the older world of burning is meeting a very newer one with pretty alarming consequences. And it's too early to start doing postmortems on the fire itself. As far as I can tell, no one still knows the cause. Canada, in fact, Alberta, had a kind of dress rehearsal for this in 2011 with the Slave Lake fire, a smaller community, but the fire there did get into the downtown areas. It was a pretty devastating and shocking event, but instead of being a wake-up call, they seem to have hit snooze alarm or something, and now we're seeing it even more violently played out. So we don't know what the particulars were, but in the Slave Lake, the cause was identified as arson. The arsonist was never caught. So again, we've got very funny collisions of things going on, interaction of people and nature in peculiar ways. And as I say, it's premature to start distributing blame and drawing our fun ironies out of all this. It's a disaster so far. It has not been a tragedy, so that plays true. But it seems to me a very interesting collision of two worlds.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pine, who's an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and the author of a number of books, the latest of which is History of Fire Since 1960. So how do the Canadians, though, measure up in terms of their ability to fight fires? Because I recall when we had fires here in Los Angeles a while back, these huge amphibious aircraft came down from Canada, and they already have bought apparently a smaller and more modern amphibious aircraft here in California to fight fires, and they rent them from Canada. But the big ones, these Martin Mars, go back to World War II, and they're massive. So it seems that the Canadians at least have, you know, developed some assets.
Well, Canada is one of the big four, you know, firepowers in the world, and they have really excelled at the technology of fire, hardware and software, pumps, water delivery systems, all this kind of stuff. Canada is a world leader. It also has world-class science. What Canada is perfectly capable of fighting fires in a large way and in a sophisticated way. And they've had to deal with very big fires over large areas. Now, they don't always try to go toe-to-toe with them. They've traditionally had a kind of line of control about 60 degrees above which they didn't try. But now, as they push developments, they may have to. And as climate change begins to affect them, they may have to change. So it's not that they can't muster a response. They certainly can at a national level, even though the provinces control the resources here. It's an Alberta show. The issue is that it's just too big. There's really nothing at this point. As I say, we have historic records of 3 million-acre fires burning throughout the entire season until the snow put them out. So until there is a major break in the weather or this fire runs into lakes, runs into old burns, something that really exhausts its fuel, there's really not much they can do. And that would be true for anybody. Canada is as sophisticated about this as any country is.
So given that, as you say, the fires burned all the way, I guess, west to through British Columbia and were only ended by the end of the season when the snow started, what happens in these out-of-control fires to the wildlife?
Well, these are as I say, historical and natural events. We see these torching forests, and that's what we see mostly because they're the most dramatic images. But most of it is patchy. It's not a tsunami of flame rolling over hundreds of thousands of acres. It's very broken. It's very patchy. The wildlife has lots of ways to escape. Not all do. Many animals live in the ground. They simply go to their burrows. Others amble about someplace out of danger. But what traditionally offers checks and balances is simply the large-scale history of these fires, burning out patches and then leaving stuff, so that you don't have huge, unbroken expanses. And what has changed over the last century or so, partly because of change in human fire use, attempts at suppression, so forth, is that you've created larger and larger patches. That will disturb the wildlife in ways I don't think we completely understand. But it alters the habitat, and there are always winners and losers. And many, many species in the boreal rely on the regrowth, the shrubs, the grass, the forbs, the berries that come up after large fires. So it is not destructive. It doesn't, you know, the immediate visual is that you've created a moonscape. The longer term, the intermediate term, is that you've really rejuvenated the landscape in ways that will favor most of the species. So it's partly a case of scale here.
So what's your sense then of this? You've made the point that there have been bigger fires in Canada's recent history. This one, of course, has gotten a lot of attention and has burned a lot of area. But now it's moving to the east into Saskatchewan. What's in its path?
Well, I'll be candid. I'm not familiar enough at the detail you need with Canadian geography in that particular area to say. I don't think there's much to break it until they begin hitting the Canadian Shield with its chain of lakes. And at that point, you get a lot more water into the mix, and so the fuels become patchier. And that would cause the fire to begin breaking down and changing character.
But you said that also that the states or the provinces control the firefighting assets. So I imagine Alberta's assets are taxed. Does that mean that Saskatchewan's assets will be thrown at this fire, or have they already been deployed?
Well, I don't know in detail. Canada has had for over 30 years an interagency arrangement where the provinces can aid one another. And the federal government of Canada also contributes, particularly in the form of some air tankers. So Alberta, even though they are the responsible agency, can call on help from B.C. and Saskatchewan and Manitoba, Ontario, all across. And the same will be true for Saskatchewan. The issue is that at some point it isn't going to help to simply muster 100 air tankers or put together 10,000 firefighters with pumps, because there's not much they can do to stop it at this point. And unless there are major assets, a major community like Fort McMurray in the way, it would be really hard to justify that kind of commitment. Canada, you know, so even though we've had large fires, and Canada continues to have large, they've had very large fires in the past few years in the Northwest Territories, for example. What makes this one different is that you don't have a modern, fairly large community in the way. And you'd have to go back really to the 1920s in Canada history to find communities hit on this scale by fires. And in those days, there were a lot more fatalities. So far, that has not been the case. So remarkable evacuations, really. Very Canadian, in a sense.
What do you mean by that?
Canada is out of experience in having these kinds of things. The kind of thing you see in Southern California
Right. Just
hasn't happened there. They've had a few, but not significant.
Right. But when you say very Canadian, just in the last few seconds, what do you mean by that?
I just think that it's sort of been civil. You don't have people running into each other.
Right.
You don't have road rage. It seems to be that they've been able to pool their interests together. I mean, as far as I can tell from Phoenix, where I'm sitting and reading reports, it was done with deliberation and seems to have been done with care.
Right.
And without the sort of free-for-all that I would associate with other places.
Well, Stephen Pine, I thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pine. He's an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and the author of a number of books, the latest of which is History of Fire Since 1960. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the tyranny of the weak now that North Korea has says it won't use nuclear weapons first.
The atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled simply The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book is just out in paperback, is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Nice to be with you again.
And do you see this extraordinary, first of all, they've had their first sort of workers' congress for some time in North Korea, and the young dynastic ruler has made this extraordinary offer saying that he would not be the first to use nuclear weapons and that they only have them to prevent attacks from hostile countries, and that they would only use them if, let me quote him, as a responsible nuclear weapon state, our republic will not use a nuclear weapon unless its sovereignty is encroached upon by any aggressive hostile forces with nuclear weapons. And then he goes on to say, we will faithfully fulfill its obligations. North Korea will faithfully fulfill its obligations for nonproliferation and strive for a global denuclearization. So is there a kind of nukes and butter offer that he's making here? I mean, here he's absolutely impoverished his own people in order to get nuclear weapons. And now he's turning around and saying he wants the world to reward him so he can feed his own people as long as we accept him as a nuclear power. Is that the subtext?
Well, I'm not surprised that he made this statement. I think that that's been clear all along, that the purpose of nuclear weapons, or at least as it's demonstrated to the outside world, is as a nuclear deterrent. And he wanted to, the North Korean leadership and Kim Jong-un personally would reach out, this is clearly a message to the United States specifically, to enter into talks to freeze or to end the nuclear program in exchange for lifting of economic sanctions. So yes, there is a kind of nukes for butter approach. This might not have been the most sensible way for Kim Jong-un to proceed if he really wanted to help his people, but I think that nuclear weapons also have a very important domestic function, that Kim Jong-un has engaged in these tests in order to prove to his own leadership and his own people that he is a very strong leader and he'll arm his country with nuclear weapons. So it's a calculated risk for both domestic politics and also for North Korea's external affairs.
But haven't the North Koreans created this illusion over the decades that they're about to be attacked? And as far as I know, the U.S. and South Korea have not had any intentions of attacking North Korea. There's no way in the world that you could do that without China coming to the defense of North Korea, or during the Cold War, Russia coming to the defense. But nevertheless, they have drummed into the North Korean people that at any moment we're going to be at war. And now he's changed the narrative. He's saying, well, now we've got nuclear weapons, which would surely mean that we're less likely to go to war and we're less likely to be attacked. And then I'm now finally protecting and defending you. So can they continue the paranoia in terms of business as usual?
Well, we'll have to see. We'll have to see where this goes. I think that this is this whole drumming up of fear of the U.S. is partly to consolidate power. But I also think that to some extent the North Koreans really believe that they're country is threatened, and certainly the media play up the South Korean-U.S. military exercises as a preparation for war. Well, what Kim Jong-un wants is to almost literally have his cake and eat it too, that is to say, be accepted by the international community as a nuclear weapon state, but as he says, a responsible nuclear weapon state. It'll rejoin the Non-Proliferation Treaty in exchange, again, for lifting of economic sanctions. So this is where they are going forward. They've also talked, and will continue to talk, I imagine, of replacing the Korean War armistice with a peace treaty with the U.S. And some people would say, well, if the U.S. is no longer the enemy, how can North Korea sustain its regime? And I think that we'll just have to see if we could actually do that. But in the meantime, what Kim Jong-un very clearly wants to show is that sanctions have not worked, and that he's not going to give up nuclear weapons under the pressure of sanctions, but can enter in some kind of talks to at least suspend and maybe ultimately dismantle this nuclear program. We'll see how this goes.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, simply titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book, just out in paperback, is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. So in terms of Tyranny of the Weak, I think it's pretty clear that the paranoia has worked in terms of the cohesion of the state, and that but lately the price they paid for getting these nuclear weapons has been pretty severe. The first round of sanctions may not have been that strong, but the second round apparently really are biting, and China is being more cooperative, and the South Koreans have closed down that factory area on the border that was a source of great deal of foreign exchange for the North Koreans. So and by the way, your point is well taken in terms of their paranoia may well be justified in the sense that the country was entirely destroyed during the Korean War, almost bombed into oblivion. So I'm sure the vestiges of that memory are there. But is there any perceptible change on the Chinese side? China has a very sort of xenophobic leader who came up during the Red Guard period of the Cultural Revolution and is kind of trying to be a throwback to Mao. Is he in any way changing? Because the Chinese have always expressed frustration, but they've never done anything about the North Korean regime.
Well, on the one hand, China not only signed on to the latest round of UN sanctions, but actually helped to design them. So clearly they are unhappy with Kim Jong-un's actions and want to send a message to North Korea. But the Chinese have been quite consistent both before Xi Jinping took power and now in their bottom line, which is, as they put it, they don't want any instability or war on the Korean Peninsula. In other words, they don't want to push North Korea so far that the regime crumbles or becomes unstable. So they'll only take this so far, and I don't see any indication that that has changed. Their frustration level has certainly increased, and I think that they have seriously discussed internally the possibility of what to do if North Korea does fall. But they don't want that to happen, and they will try to put enough pressure on North Korea to get it to stop its nuclear development, but not enough to really create any internal problems, and that might not work. It certainly hasn't worked so far.
So my understanding is that intelligence agencies estimate that North Korea probably has about 20 nuclear weapons now, and by 2020 we'll have about 100. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that's what I've heard as well. But not only that, they have said that they're capable of miniaturizing a nuclear weapon, although that has not been confirmed, and they continue to test long-range missiles and announced a few weeks ago that they were able to launch a missile from a submarine. So their ability to send these weapons to their intended targets very far away is also growing, and that is certainly something that's quite worrisome.
So I'm wondering whether the George W. Bush, Dick Cheney era has had an effect on the so-called axis of evil countries, which you recall Iran, Iraq, and North Korea were the axis of evil countries that George W. Bush pointed to. And here you have the North Koreans now with nuclear weapons and building them up to about an arsenal of 100 by 2020. You have the Iranians essentially making a deal based upon the fact that they will stop a nuclear weapons program. So has the invasion of Iraq looking for non-existent nuclear weapons sent a signal around the world that you got to get hold of these damn things because they're really valuable bargaining chips?
Yes, it certainly has, and it especially has affected North Korea, and their officials have said that quite explicitly. After the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and let's not forget the invasion of Libya and the collapse of the Gaddafi regime there just a few years ago, after Libya had signed a denuclearization agreement with the U.S., has convinced the North Korean leadership that if you open up your country to inspections and you give up nuclear weapons, that's when the U.S. will attack. So the message is exactly the opposite, I think, of what the Bush-Cheney people wanted to give, which is not if you are threatening another country, they will give up nuclear weapons, but precisely that if you have nuclear weapons, the U.S. will not be able to threaten you. And that's a very unfortunate message to have been received. And, of course, it's not just about North Korea, but many countries in the world are watching the situation to see what can be done.
So what's your understanding then of how North Korea was able to pull this off, being so isolated and so impoverished and having, you know, I think about a third of its population were in starvation only a decade ago, and apparently they've had bad droughts, etc., and they may even have to have more starvation. So how could they pull this off? Where did they get their technical ability from, particularly if they have successfully miniaturized nuclear weapons? And usually that means that you go the thermonuclear route because that's how you get more bang for a smaller weapon.
Well, I think North Korea made a decision that nuclear weapons are actually more economical than having a huge standing army. It's a way of compensating for their weakness. Nuclear weapons, as I've written, are the ultimate weapon of the weak for these small countries that feel beleaguered. So they have an army that really couldn't stand up to the North Koreans, the South Koreans, even though they're very large. They're under-equipped. They don't have much fuel and so on. And it's a very tightly controlled country, as we all know. So they're able to keep the populace in line and divert resources into a nuclear program. They've had long-standing connections to the Pakistani nuclear program and, of course, to the Soviets and to the Chinese. So they've managed to do just enough. This is not a terribly sophisticated or impressive program. There's been lots of failures, but they've managed to barely get by, keep their economy alive, and develop a basic nuclear program which continues to grow. And as long as the regime remains as it is, that is, isolated and keeping its people away from a lot of external information and able to be under control, then they can probably continue to do this.
Well, it's interesting, though, surely, Charles Armstrong, the difference here between the Iranian nuclear weapon that may or may not have been in underway. I think the chances are pretty strong that they were working on it, but they appear to have satisfied the G5 plus one, and the fact that there was a G5 plus one weighing in, it wasn't just the Americans, it was the Chinese, the Russians, the Germans, the French, and the British. You don't have a G5 plus one weighing in against North Korea, but you do have South Korea and Japan as being the ones that could possibly go nuclear. And in response to the fact that North Korea has gone nuclear, that was one of the arguments, I think, why the world rallied around to stop the Iranian bomb, was because the Saudi Arabians would then get one. So why has that logic not worked in the Korean Peninsula?
Well, there was an attempt to do just that. In fact, before the G5 plus one negotiated over Iran, there was six-party talks about North Korea that included the two Koreas, China, the U.S., Russia, and Japan. And that made some headway. They had a pretty comprehensive agreement by September 2005, and in early 2007, North Korea started to dismantle their nuclear power plant. But obviously things have gone a long way since then, and the six-party talks collapsed basically after North Korea's nuclear test in 2009. And so North Korea made the decision to go forward with their nuclear program and then, as they see it, negotiate from a position of strength. So theoretically, we could go back to a multilateral set of talks. And the U.S. is certainly very concerned, with the possible exception of candidate Trump, or presumptive candidate Trump, who has said that maybe North Korea, maybe South Korea and Japan should have nuclear weapons. But for the most part, American leaders have been very resistant to the notion that South Korea and Japan should have a nuclear arsenal, and the kind of chain reaction of nuclearization across Northeast Asia could be very dangerous and destabilizing. But the big difference, or one of the big differences between Iran and North Korea, is precisely the fact that North Korea is so isolated. Iran could really be affected by economic sanctions, especially on its oil exports. And Iran had an active civil society, a middle class, that was really protesting the effects of sanctions. We don't see that in North Korea, and that's a major reason that sanctions have not worked on the North, and we are where we are today.
So going forward then, in the last couple of minutes, then, Charles Armstrong, do you think that Kim Jong-un is going to win this? Is he going to be able to effectively blackmail the West again, essentially getting rewarded for bad behavior? Now we've got the bombs, but we say we're not going to be the first to use them. So now it's time for you to help us out so that we can have both nukes and butter.
Well, I think that if any kind of agreement is reached with North Korea, I can't say that explicitly and clearly the U.S. would not accept a long-term de facto recognition of North Korea as a nuclear weapon state. But we have to start somewhere, and I think that what could be done is that North Korea would promise to suspend or to freeze its nuclear program while talks are taking place, and ultimately have the goal of denuclearization. It's not a very attractive picture to anyone, but it's the reality of where we are, and it's certainly preferable, in my view, to a military option or to continued use of sanctions, which simply do not work, and I don't see them having a profound effect. Certainly, the sanctions have hurt and will hurt North Korea economically, but they're not going to have a decisive effect unless they're combined with some sort of negotiation which will get North Korea out of the situation it is now. Again, something like Iran. So, we shouldn't underestimate how well North Korea plays this game. They've been doing it for decades, and they're masterful at playing a very weak hand very effectively, what I call the tyranny of the weak. We see this again, and they've created facilitated a situation where there is no realistic or palatable alternative than to negotiate with North Korea from where they are now.
Well, Charles Armstrong, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled simply The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book, just out in paperback, is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.